This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The Women's Hoop Show, a podcast hosted by me, Jordan Robinson, brings you fresh women's basketball voices and breakdowns every week. I'll be joined by hoop experts all year long. Find the Women's Hoop Show on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
9:09 now. Wait, Jordan Fiegel's telling me something in my ear. What is it? The NFL owners have now approved changes to the league's instant replay. I'm repeating it as he tells me. They're going to make it retroactive to go back to the 2018 season and include missed pass interference calls. And that means that the Saints and the Rams will replay the 2018 NFC Championship game that was held in January of 2019. But in order to make it fair, they're going to have to use the same players. So Drew Brees is going to have to come out of retirement, and both rosters will have to be exactly the same. Jordan, is that what you're telling me? That sounds like that movie The Best of Times with Kurt Russell and Robin Williams, where they go back and replay that high school game. Well, that's indeed interesting. Oh, wait a minute. It's April Fool's Day. Jeff Nowak joins us now, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
You had me in the first half.
Did I?
In the first
did
half.
I really?
Yeah.
No kidding.
Well, I mean, part of it's true. They have expanded replay a little bit.
Let's talk about what's happened so far since we did start with that. First of all, how you doing, all right?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Good. A pleasure to talk to you as always. Tell me about what the NFL owners have approved so far, what changes we're going to see in next season.
Yeah, so basically the owners' meetings are going on right now, and they always vote on all these proposed rule changes. So there's usually a dozen or so teams submit, hey, I want this rule changed. And, if it gets through that final process, then they vote on them. The Saints actually don't have any submitted this year. There's always certain teams that tend to be in on this. The Lions, for whatever reason, always have a bunch. But, yeah, so far, the only rule changes that have gone through, as far as I understand, are the rules are changing now to basically turn the playoff overtime rules into regular season overtime rules, in that both teams will be allowed to possess the ball. There's been a lot of changes over the years. If you go back to the Super Bowl, the same Super Bowl, it was, if you kick a field goal on your opening possession, game's over. Mm-hmm. They changed that a few years later so that if you kick a field goal, the other team got a chance to score a touchdown. But if you score a touchdown, the game's over. Now, even if you score a touchdown, the other team still gets the ball and the chance to at least rebut that. And then it would become the first team that scores, which, I think if you're a team that's ever been on the side of, we go into overtime and the offense never gets to touch the ball, I think you would support that rule change.
But wait, let me jump in for a second, because I was confused about there being a difference between playoffs and regular season overtime, the difference being that there can be a tie in regular season, but not that was the difference, or what did they change?
There were a few differences. One being, that if the first overtime period ended, then it would go as a tie, which I think you just don't want to get into a situation where you're playing a second football game because neither offense can score, and then you get into a situation with injuries. But you obviously can't have a tie in the playoffs. So in the playoffs, it would just go on until somebody wins. So that's still going to be the case. You can still have a game end in a tie. They did try to get it to be 15 minutes instead of 10, but that got kind of pushed back and amended down to 10 so that they could get it to pass. So the real change is both teams get a chance to get the ball. The other thing that's been changed is they've expanded the replay assist, which we've seen used in situations. I need to kind of look in to see all of the definitions of this rule and what's allowed to be looked at and what's not. But over the last few years, you've seen, a ball's been called complete. And then on the replay, you can clearly see that it hit the ground rather than forcing the other team to throw a challenge flag and have a 5-minute review. they say, oh, replay assist has overturned that to an incompletion. Like, we've seen that. Mm-hmm. They've now added the ability to pick up flags in that system. So if there's a pass interference that is very clear that, hey, that guy didn't touch him, he tripped over his own feet, he went down, they could pick up that flag. They can't add a flag. So that's the difference. Now, Saints fans will be like, wow, what if this existed in 2019, like you were talking about? Mm-hmm. It actually wouldn't have changed anything, because you cannot go back and add a flag where there was not a flag. But kind of like the NBA's rule, like, you can't review something and add a foul. You can't go back on the NFL and say, well, it was clearly pass interference, but it wasn't called, so you can add it. That's not how it works.
Somebody texted in about electronic tracking for ball placement. Have there been any suggestions at all that they're looking at to try to make the game? See, because one thing I would like to see changed is it's obviously a missed call or a bad call, and the other team hurries up and snaps the ball. That, to me, is just blatant cheating, because it's like, okay, well, we know it wasn't a catch, so we're going to go ahead and hurry up and snap the ball before the right thing can happen. And that, to me, sets a bad example for everybody. Thoughts?
I mean, that's just kind of, that's the rule, right? But at the same time, like, a lot of times, like, hey, we're not sure if that was a catch. It's not like, oh, it's definitely not a catch. You just don't want to run the risk. So you run a quick play.
Jeffrey? You know, I think that's the idea. Jeffrey, what's your middle name? What's your middle name?
Douglas. Actually.
Jeffrey, yeah. Douglas, come along now. Come on now. Let's be honest. Don't tell me. Don't feed that stuff to me, mister. Your father may buy it, but I'm not going to buy it. I'm not going to believe that they don't know that they're just rushing, right? Because just in case. Come on, man.
Well, they know they don't want it to get looked at. That doesn't mean that it was definitely. Like,
it's
sometimes
cheating.
You'll see it and like, oh,
it's
it was a
blatant
catch anyway.
Cheating, and they know it is.
Well, but here's the thing. That's what the replay assist is supposed to help with, right? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times teams won't have the amount of time necessary to get a good replay, especially if you're on the road. Like, this is something I figured out standing on the sideline of games. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll watch it on TV, and they're showing you the replay on TV 10 times by the time that the coach is throwing the flag. But when you're standing on the sidelines, especially on the road, they're not showing you those replays. Like, stadiums understand that the coach on the sideline would very much like to see that replay with his own eyes before throwing that challenge flag. So they're not showing it. At least not until, you know, maybe after it's too late. So that's where the replay assist comes in of, like, the coach has to hear from upstairs watching it on TV, like, oh, they just showed it. Okay, we got it. But a lot of times it doesn't have enough time to happen. So the replay assist kind of takes away that gamesmanship, which I think would be the word I would use as opposed to cheating. It would be gamesmanship.
Kind of
takes
right.
away that
sure.
opportunity. If it's obvious.
But now I'm all for, look, I play golf, I'm all for the rules. Sometimes the rules help you. Sometimes it takes a tree out of play if you're on a cart path. Sometimes it puts a tree in play. I'm all for that. But this just seems like, you know, you're trying to hurry up and get this off before they notice you did something wrong. But along those lines, I always thought, too, since we're having a conversation here, that it was crazy that you only get so many challenges as a coach, even if you're right. It seems to me, as long as you're correcting the officials, if the goal is to get it right, I don't see how you, maybe after one or two wrong challenges, you lose them, but you should be able to keep going forever if you're right and challenging the officials. Am I wrong or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like, I think there's an officials lobby that comes into play at some point being like, can we not? Because if we're screwing up constantly, we don't want it to be pointed out.
But I mean,
constantly.
it's like you.
No, I agree with you.
You corrected me four. I screwed up four times. Calls. Right, I screwed up four times. You've called me out four times, but you can't do it anymore. Well, if anything, that would be the reason I should be able to do it more, because you're screwing this thing up.
Exactly. Like, if the calls were wrong, then why do I lose the ability to point it out again? I agree with that 100%. I think the same thing's true in the NBA, but to an extent, like, I understand in the NBA, because there's kind of this, if you've ever played basketball, there's kind of this understanding. It's like, well, we're not going to call the foul because you clearly fouled him and it went off like the tip of his fingers. So, okay, well, we're just going to give them the ball and we're not going to deal with the foul. But then you challenge and then suddenly it's like, well, we can't call the foul, but it's definitely out of bounds on them. That doesn't really exist in football. Either you did it or you didn't.
I don't know how in the NBA, and now we're really getting off, but I don't know how they call a foul in the NBA. Do you? Because they have their hands all over each other constantly. I don't understand.
It's tough.
I don't get any sport,
but yeah.
So what's likely to pass? I know Tim told me that they get to wear alternative uniforms 4 years. For Tim's the fashion police. He keeps me updated on that. But is there anything substantial likely to change? Tush push. Are they going to do away with that or not?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one on the docket right now. Every year one team or another tries to ban the tush push. I think it's going to get banned eventually. I don't know if it's going to be this year. The issue they're going to run into is, in most cases, at least for the NFL, they try to hedge on the idea of like, okay, we're going to change rules when it's a safety issue. So players are getting hurt during this play, so we're going to change the kickoff, for example. Like, players were getting hurt, so they tried to find a way to keep the kickoff in the game while tamping down on the injuries. And that's what Darren Rizzi's dynamic kickoff thing, it actually did that, so they're going to keep it. Now, the tush push, it really doesn't – like, injuries are really not a part of it. You don't really see guys getting injured. I think the argument that coaches would make is, like, the longer this goes on, the more kind of aggressive strategies defenses are going to take, and that you might see situations like we saw in the playoffs where guys start diving over the line, guys are doing whatever they can. I think at the end of the day, it's going to end up getting banned because it has the cardinal sin of being boring. It is a boring football play, and it is not a play that the NFL wants games to come down to, right? The NFL doesn't want a rugby match breaking out in the middle of an NFL football game.
Right.
And the thing is, the Eagles are just way better at it than everybody else. But we've seen over the last few years other teams start to get better at it. And when you have the quarterback and the center who can do it, it's just common sense. Hey, anytime I'm in a short yardage scenario, I'm going to do this. And it's going to, and over time, it's going to become, hey, there's 8 teams in the league that do this constantly. And then it's going to be half the league. And then suddenly, if you're not running this play, then you are wasting an opportunity. So does the NFL want a game to turn into that? Does the NFL want every short yardage scenario to be this, like, 3-6 inches in a cloud of dust thing that's basically impossible to stop? No. So, it's going to happen, and people are going to be like, well, that doesn't make any sense. But rule changes to maintain the entertainment value of a game have existed as long as the games have existed. You see, in baseball, why do you think they have a pitch clock now? Mm-hmm. That's not a safety issue. That's an entertainment value issue. They banned shifts because it was kind of boring to watch these great hitters hit screaming line drives into the side of the infield with 5 fielders. That's not fun to watch, right? I want to see base hits. I want to see action. In the NBA, they banned transition take fouls because, hey, I want to see dunks. I want to see breakaway dunks. That's exciting. In the NFL, why do you think defensive holding exists, right? Why do you think they've added all of these rules to make it impossible to cover receivers? Because it's more fun to watch a receiver catch the ball and run down the field than it is to watch, 10 incomplete passes in a row. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to come down to this point that they're going to hedge it on injuries, but it's going to come down to, hey, I just want to watch a football game where it does not come down to this every drive.
You, my friend, we got to go. You are very talented, and I love talking to you, but I do remember during the Kansas City game, Travis Kelce running about as fast and as hard as he could into the back of Patrick Mahomes trying to get him into the end zone, and I'm watching this thinking, eventually this is going to lead to somebody getting hurt, don't you think?
It'll only take one high-profile quarterback getting hurt in that scenario for it to, become a injury issue. But the numbers will never support it. Like, when you look at the percentage of players injured on an average NFL play versus the percentage of players injured on this specific NFL play, it's never going to be, this is a problem play like the kickoff was. But no, I mean, Josh Allen and the Bills have been running it a lot. If suddenly Josh Allen, shatters his ankle because someone steps on it or he gets pushed and he hyperextends his neck because he's in a bad situation and someone's pushing him from behind, then it'll become a problem. It's just a question of whether the NFL lets it get to that point or just kind of nips it in the bud, which I would prefer they did because it's not a fun play to watch. Like, I don't want to watch it. Mm-hmm. I get it. They're good at it. It's within the rules. But, again, the rules exist until the rules don't exist. Like, all you have to do is say, hey, you're not allowed to push players from behind. in these situations. That's all you have to do.
When
and
you,
then suddenly it's a sneak again.
When you're at home watching it, are you going, no, are you not?
Right.
That's how I watch it.
Well,
it's. And you're right. It's like a scrum. That was a point well made. It is like a scrum in rugby. That's what you're looking at, basically. Right?
Right. It would be like saying, hey, the most exciting play is like these backward lateral plays. Like, no, that's rugby. If you want to watch these backward lateral schoolyard plays, go watch a rugby game. That's what it is. I don't know. I think that at the end of the day, the NFL game is more fun when you're playing NFL football and not, you know, this weird kind of, hey, we're really good at this, so we're going to do it. Like, I had someone say, hey, it's a play that only happens 2 to 3 times a game. It's like, no, you're confusing that with a sneak. I have watched the Eagles run this play 2 to 3 times on individual drives. The playoffs against Washington, they actually stopped it once. And then their response was, we're going to do hard counts because the only way you can stop this is to jump the snap. So we're going to do hard counts. And then they end up getting 5 off. Offsides penalties in a row to the point that the ref's like, hey, if you do that again, we're just going to give them the touchdown. Like, that's a playoff game. That's not what you want a playoff game to come down to. And it's just become ridiculous.
What do you think about being able to pick up a quarterback and use him like a battering ram like they used to do in the Flintstones? Kind of like that. What do you think, huh?
Yeah, like in Lord of the Rings where they had like the big thing where they knocked it against the door a bunch of times until it breaks.
Yeah, battering ram.
They
call it the old battering ram. The Rams. Sean McVay should create that play and call it the battering ram. We're on to something, Jeff. Tell me about the
podcast. On the roster where that's his only job is to come in and get knocked against the line.
Hardhead McMahon, that's what you can call him. Look, if you like listening to Jeff just now, as I do, tell him about the podcast, Jeff, with you and Steve.
Yeah, Inside Black and Gold. We're going to record an episode probably later today talking about Kellen Moore, what he had to say at the owners' meetings. He talked for about a half hour. We haven't really gotten into it, but didn't really say a ton. But we'll get into what he had to say. Talked about they're going to have training camp in Metairie this year. Yay, sweating. I do still think they're going to go out to have joint practices somewhere. Hey, maybe in Irvine again. Who knows? But, yeah, we're going to get into a lot of that. We're going to talk about just general stuff from the offseason, you know, mock drafts, all that good stuff. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find it on YouTube at WWL Sports. A lot of good stuff on there. So check it out.
I didn't bring it up because I didn't want to steal your podcast thunder. Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure as always. Jeffrey Douglas Nowak. Jordan tweeted me, Jeff, no fun league, Nowak. Apparently because he's a Jalen Hurts fan, he loves the tush push. Thank you, Jeff. 9:25, we come back. We'll talk about Americans being unhappy as it relates or unhappier than the rest of the world. We'll talk about some keys to happiness when we return on WWL. It is 9:31, a little bit late. We're concerned about mental health here. We every Tuesday talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Good morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. How's Luca?
He is good. We just got back from a little vacation. So, yeah, he's just recovering.
Awesome. You know what I've been doing? I got a new dog. What I've been doing is loading a Nerf gun with a ball and shooting it across the yard, which is about 30 yards wide. And when he comes back, I give him a little treat, and it wears him out pretty quickly. I don't know if you want to try that with Luca. I'm just kidding. It's a joke. I'm just playing. Happy April's Fool's Day to you. Do you suggest people make April Fool's jokes or not as a licensed clinical neuropsychologist?
I always think that they're fun, but, you know, some people can't take a joke, right? So I guess you have to know your audience.
Yeah, you know that because you own your own practice. If you work for somebody and you find yourself in human resources, you suddenly realize as you're sitting there at the conference table and you thought that was funny and you say, at the time, yeah, I guess I did, but certainly not now. Am I fired? Let's talk about World Happiness Country Rankings. The United States not doing so well behind Finland, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden, Netherlands, Costa Rica, Norway, Israel, Luxembourg, Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, Switzerland, Belgium, Ireland, Lithuania, Austria, Canada, Slovenia, Czechia. Is that a Russian country or is that, I don't know, UAE, what? It's a Russian country. I didn't know if that was a shorthand for Czechoslovakia. Countries, Dr. Judy, who can keep track of them? UAE, Germany, and the U.S. and the U.K. Why is the U.S. so unhappy?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I actually recall the World Happiness Rankings, and we actually talk about it in a couple of my classes that I teach at Pepperdine. And there's usually 6 key predictors of national happiness. One is GDP per capita. So I think if we were going by that, you'd think that America would be very high up top. But the other one that's really important is social support. Do people really feel like they have someone to count on in times of need? And in general, if you're from a country where family structures are a bit close-knit, you're in much closer connection with your neighbors, the people in your community, you're going to score much higher on that. And I think that America overall tends to score a bit lower on that than other countries, especially because we're an individualistic country. Most of the times, one of the values that people hold is that we should be independent. And so it's just not like how it is in certain more collectivistic countries where it's just the norm that you see lots of people every day and that you connect with people, that sometimes you put your needs behind the group's needs because that's really what helps everybody to feel better. We're just not really used to thinking that way. So I think that social support is a big part of it. A couple of the other key predictors of national happiness: healthy life expectancy, freedom to make life choices, generosity, and then perception of corruption. So that's interesting, right? So a lot of countries are very corrupt.
You're talking about the government of the countries or the institutions?
Yeah, I think that it's more about trust or distrust in society and government. But it's the perception, and that I think is the key. So obviously there's corruption everywhere. It's just the fact of life, right? But it's really your perception of how corrupt your country's government or society is. And as you know, Tommy, our country is in a lot of turmoil right now emotionally about the government. Everybody has such strong opinions. There's a lot of distrust. There's even some paranoia. I mean, sometimes there is something unseemly going on. Other times there may not be, but you still think that there are, and you're getting really worked up about it. So I think that that could also play a role. And then I think it's just this idea of work-life balance, right? So even this idea of freedom to make life choices, this is one of the most important, like one of the six key predictors of national happiness. We have a lot of freedom in America, but a lot of people feel like, again, this is because of the cultural value and cultural norm, that they have to just be grinding really hard at work. There isn't the kind of work-life balance that there often is with some of the countries that are near the top of the National Happiness Survey. And so I think that, you know, those are, in my opinion, the main reasons why America is so much lower than we might expect.
One thing that does make me unhappy is when I'm fed wrong information. By Tim Zimmer in Master Control, Chechia is the name of the Czech Republic. Chechnya is in Russia. Thank you, Tim. I'm able to sound stupid on my own. I don't need your help, okay? I'm just kidding. Thank you. It sounds like Chechnya. I'm not ragging on you, Tim. I just wanted to clear that up for the audience. Dr. Judy, let's talk about the role of social support here. And somebody texted me 2 hours ago. And said they feel as though, because I knew you were coming on, we were talking about it, they feel as though, and it was a long test, I'll try to paraphrase it. Basically, have you seen these movies where the dive ships go and they leave the person alone and the dive ship is gone and they're all by themselves? They say that's how they feel in their life. You never seen those movies?
Oh, okay. Cool.
You've never seen them? Yeah, they're diving, and then everybody loads up on a dive ship, and they miscount how many people the boat, and they go about, and a person's just left there adrift in the water, and nobody comes
nightmare.
And gets them. Yeah, it is a nightmare. And they said that's how they feel socially. I've seen a couple of those movies. That's why I knew what they were talking about. And they said that's how they feel, that they're out there treading water for as long as they can, and that nobody's coming. They have a family member that's occasionally like a plane that flies overhead to make sure they're still there, and they don't know what to do. So exactly. That was my response. And when I saw that and thought about world happiness rankings, I thought, well, this person is certainly among the unhappy in the United States. So what would you even tell them to start? What? How? I don't know. I mean, you need more details, but generally speaking.
Yeah. You know, I think that in general, when people are feeling a bit, I mean, seriously adrift, this is a very good metaphor that this person just gave. It's important to remember that you don't need 1,000 friends. You don't need 100 friends. You don't even need 10 friends. You just need, you know, 1, 2, or 3 really quality people that you can have a deeper connection with. That's what we're talking about in terms of social support. We're not talking about you are best friends with all of the neighbors on your street. We're talking about people who actually really mean something, who you can really count on. And you may say, well, I just have literally no one like that in my life. And I think the goal is to really just start small and just try to cultivate one meaningful relationship at a time. So the easiest way is to start with the people who are already in your social circle and think about, well, is there somebody here that maybe if I put a little bit more effort in, especially if they were also, you know, going to respond in kind, like that, that would result in a more meaningful connection with this person. And then just reach out to them and, you know, call them, ask them out for a coffee or a lunch, like start spending more time with them, you know, but it does take you having to extend the olive branch a little bit because nobody can read your mind. Nobody knows that you want to have a deeper connection with them unless you do something about it. If you really feel like no one in your life fits that type of bill, then, you know, challenging yourself to join something in the community, join something like a volunteer activity, and try to meet some people who you might be able to establish a connection with that way. But
Doctor, I scroll down.
To start with one person.
I scrolled down like 18 pages because I wanted to get this right for this person. And the text said, I feel as though my family left me behind, much like a diver whose boat leaves without him, and I don't know how much longer I can tread water. That was the exact text. So I don't know if that changes anything that I said earlier or not. But so you're saying basically try to find somebody?
Yeah, just find one person to start. And it might not be the people that you thought it was going to be, right? So I think this person is saying their family is not there for them. And, you know, a lot of people end up creating their own families, right? It might not be your family of origin. It might be other people that can try to fill that role. And I think sometimes the pain comes from, and of course you have to grieve that, you know, comes from, well, but my family should be the people who are the ones there for me. It doesn't mean it won't change at some point down the line. You know, things are not static. Sometimes people will say, well, it'll never change with my mom, et cetera. It's like, well, it's possible, but it's also possible she might, you know? So it's not necessarily that it's going to go on forever, that you have a strained relationship with your family members. But at least as it is right now, it's helpful to try to let go of that expectation that your closest inner circle should be certain people, you know, because that also adds to the perception of loneliness and sadness and not feeling connected.
Somebody texted in, tell that person go to a good non-denominational church. They'll be welcome and have more friends than they know what to do with quickly. So I guess that's an idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Volunteer,
exactly.
I would think, that with an organization, maybe volunteer with somebody, get to know somebody there. Doctor, do you do deep sea diving?
I don't.
Because I can tell you, the movies open water, and they have like three of them, open water 1, 2, or 3, if you ever want to watch those. We'll take a break, come back. We're talking to Dr. Judy about ways to be happy. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870, and I will ask you, you don't have to tell me your name or anything, but generally speaking, scale of 1 to 10, where are you when it comes to happiness? And I'll ask Dr. Judy when we come back, what is a reasonable expectation as we all matriculate through life as to a good number to be on the happiness scale? I think if you're hitting 6, you're doing pretty good considering everything, but we'll see. 942, 18 till 10, more when we return. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 9:47, 13 till 10, couple of minutes left with Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, instructor at Cal Pepperdine. I get that right?
At Pepperdine? Yeah, I'm a tenured professor there.
Tenured professor at, what is it? Cal Pepperdine.
Pepperdine University.
Pepperdine University. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Dr. Judy, for my ignorance.
No problem.
Let's talk about, somebody texted in and said, happiness is all about expectations. I cannot allow myself to expect anything from anybody, and that way I can't get disappointed. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, definitely I think that that's a tactic, but also don't not allow yourself to have some expectations. Sometimes that's okay. But I understand that. I do understand that as a coping strategy and as a personality trait where it's like, okay, well, if I just don't put a ton of expectations on someone, then I'm not going to be upset if they don't do what I want to have them do. But I do think that it's okay to have some expectations, especially if you communicate them to that person, right? I mean, I think that what's hard is if you expect them to do something and they have no idea what your standards are, and then all of a sudden you're upset and they're like, wait, why was that something I was supposed to do to make you happy? But if it's somebody that you trust and love and you want to say, hey, you know what makes me feel really special? If you do X, like, or you know what makes me happy? If you do this from time to time. If you tell that to them and then they don't do it, then at least you have a starting place to talk about it and to negotiate. But I think it's okay to have some expectations if you communicate them ahead of time.
See, and I'm going to play devil's advocate here and ask you, what would be the downside of not having any expectations? Because just from the logic, not emotional standpoint, it would seem, well, you can't be disappointed if you don't have any expectations, but if somebody does do something nice for you, then it will be even more enjoyable because you didn't expect it. Where's my thinking wrong?
Well, I would counter that. It's very natural for human beings, just the way our minds are built, to have expectations is actually what helps us to navigate the world. You know, like, what do I expect in this situation versus this other situation? And I think that when you say you don't have any expectations, it's really coming out of a place of trying to protect yourself. So even though maybe deep down you do have some expectations, you're saying that you don't. And so I think that it's just impossible for human beings to not have any expectations. Like, it's okay to have few. I think that makes sense. But I think just the way that our brains are, it's hard not to, because we're built that way. It's evolutionarily driven. You know, we have to be able to know what to expect so that we can navigate the world better and survive better. So I would just ask this person, are you being 100% honest that you have zero expectations of anyone in your life? Like, would you have an expectation that if you were in a life-threatening situation, that if you called somebody, they'd be there for you? Like, or do you really have not even that expectation of somebody that you care about?
I guess, right? What they meant more, and maybe I'm wrong here, I interpreted it more as, you know, on a personal relationship, as opposed to, obviously, you expect the police to come if you call them. You expect the people at work to do their job, even if they tell you the country's wrong. You expect those kind of things. But when it comes to personal, expecting somebody to do this for you or do that for you, not in a work or public service kind of thing. That's how I interpreted it, but maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, obviously we can't ask this listener exactly what they mean, but right. I would say that in general, you know, people who don't say they don't have any expectations means that they don't actually feel like they can have someone they can lean on in hard times. So yeah. I just want to make sure that if that's the angle, then, you know, opening yourself up to saying, yeah, I do have some expectations of how I should be treated by the people that I love. And that is part of that perception of social support. That is a happiness factor index. So, you know, I think that it's okay. It's okay to have expectations, but making sure that they're reasonable and they're communicated properly. I just think that it's too hard to expect yourself to not have expectations of anyone. I just don't know how easy that would be, really, for every single aspect of your life, especially with the people that you cherish the most and are the closest to you.
Suppose, wait, I lost my train of thought here, because somebody told me to Google Pepperdine University, and I did. They pay you to go there?
They pay you? I mean,
you. I'm saying they pay you to go to work there?
Yes.
It's so beautiful, you should pay them. That's the only point I'm making. Real quick, before we leave, what is reasonable to expect in happiness in your life, because it is about, you know, maybe what do they say in sales, where you over deliver and under promise, over deliver. What is reasonable to expect on a scale of 1 to 10 in everyday life to be happy? You're not going to be 10 all the time. That's not real.
No, exactly. No, you're not going to be a 10 every day. And it's okay not to be. I mean, that's the whole point of life. You're going to enjoy the tens more when they happen only infrequently. Otherwise, how would you know the difference? And so, you know, I think that this is part of the problem, whether it's expectations of people that you love, like similar to what your last listener was just talking about in their text, or like expectations of your own happiness level every day. I think that we usually oftentimes overshoot it, you know, and it's really just about, well, am I able to do the things for myself or ask for help when I need to get myself to that slightly higher level of happiness today? It's okay that sometimes it's a 2, because things can happen sometimes, or maybe you struggle with clinical depression and there's going to be those days. But it's really about, am I able to kind of take a look, self-reflect, and say, here's what I can do to boost my mood a bit today, whether it's an activity I can do myself, a coping strategy that I know works, or reaching out to one or two people that I know always make me feel better if I talk to them or spend time with them. Like, it's just about having personal agency to change your happiness from moment to moment. And if you have that locked in, you're going to feel a lot better. And it's not really about the day-to-day, I have to be a 10 or a 9 or an 8, because human life, we're going to be up and down. That's just how it is. And so even just having that level of expectation is super important. And by the way, the happiest countries, they tend to know that a little bit more and kind of understand that concept. They normalize moderate expectations. So that's an interesting fact, right? Nordic culture is always at the top of this happiness survey. They tend to normalize having a moderate expectation of life. So that's what I was saying about not having no expectations at all, but not having high ones, just having moderate ones. And also they prioritize contentment over constant striving. So it's not always about the hustle and bustle. Sometimes it's about just slowing down and say, I just want to enjoy the day. And that's okay. That doesn't make me a lazy person.
I enjoy the day. I'm happy when I talk to you, Dr. Judy Ho, licensed clinical neuropsychologist, tenured professor at Pepperdine University. Taking a break, coming back, WWL.